Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Wednesday. It's June 26. Currently 64 degrees here in Old Town Park City, reporting 67 degrees in the Heber Valley with some clouds. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Nate Larson. Good morning, Nate.
Hey, good morning, Leslie. Good morning, Wasatch back. Yeah, clouds indicating some changes on the way. Moisture moving up from the southwest. Around the ridge that's been in place is going to generate a risk of showers and thunderstorms into the afternoon. So we could use some moisture and some relief from these hotter temperatures than what we're used to. Still 87 in Park City for this afternoon. Again, a chance of scattered moisture as the ridge starts to shift east, coupled with a storm system passing to the northwest. That's going to allow for some of these storms to take shape, and this pattern will continue into tomorrow. Overnight lows near 57, could see a few overnight scattered storms with mostly cloudy skies early on Thursday, clearing it by the afternoon. 80 degrees for the high tomorrow, so it is going to be a little cooler. We have that chance of thunderstorms, though, continuing tomorrow as well, clearing into Friday. Temperatures overnight into Friday, about 50, 77 for the high on Friday, so a near seasonal day with lots of sunshine for the end of the work week after these few days of storms. We climb over the weekend as high pressure builds back in. Temperatures back into the mid-80s on Saturday and on Sunday. Should see another trough move in, just clipping northern Utah Sunday night into Monday, so we'll drop temperatures early next week. It's a dry front, though, so we're not expecting any moisture. We'll have sunny conditions on Monday with highs near 79 or 80 degrees Monday into Tuesday. For Heber, similar conditions, of course, a chance of showers and storms today and tomorrow. Clearing out into Friday. Should see plenty of sunshine. We're in the low 90s for Heber today, 86 tomorrow, and then mid-80s on Friday. Just fantastic weather is expected as we round off the work week. Over the weekend, we're back in the low 90s as high pressure builds back in with sunshine dropping into the mid to upper 80s early next week behind that dry front Sunday into Monday.
Okay, Nate, thanks so much.
You bet.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Ben Anderson from Song Summit and Meredith Lavitt. We've got details on a couple of upcoming ACO shows and the latest on the Park City Song Summit and newly named Foundation Executive Director. Later on, Park City Manager Matt Dias will preview this week's two city council meetings. They'll be meeting Thursday afternoon and again Friday morning. And then from the special events department, Jenny Dearson and Heather Weinstock will discuss some upcoming events, including, of course, the very popular 4th of July celebration and the opening of the Deer Valley Music Festival. And then stay tuned for the Mountain Life. Today's guests include Stephen Casimiro. He's a former editor of Powder Magazine and National Geographic Adventure and continues with the ongoing series of The Mountain Life on print publication in the outdoor adventure realm. Then local author Cindy Clark talks about her new book, Strategic Weight Loss, 20 Practical and Effective Strategies for Lifelong Success. All of that, of course, coming up on The Mountain Life, heard every Wednesday morning at 9. Well, taking a look at some local election results, housing advocate Megan McKenna defeated fellow Democrat and Snyderville Basin Planning Commissioner Thomas Cook in yesterday's primary election. McKenna will go on to face North Summit Fire District Treasurer Ari Ioannidis, a Republican, in the November general election for Summit County Council Seat C. The Summit County Clerk's unofficial results show McKenna garnered just over 55% of the vote compared to Cook's 45%. 2,388 Democratic ballots were cast. That's about a 35% turnout. Overall voter turnout was 39%. South Summit residents also chose two candidates for school board seat two to advance to the nonpartisan general election. More than half of the 371 votes went to Dan Eckert and Garrett Carpenter, who beat Rex Anderson and James Blazard. For U.S. House District 1, which includes Kimball Junction and Northern Summit County, Representative Blake Moore garnered more than 43,000 votes, almost triple the number of his Republican challenger, Paul Miller. Entrepreneur Hoang Nang beat out tech executive Jeff Howell for Utah House District 23, which includes Summit Park and parts of Salt Lake County. And then the results will be made official at a special meeting of the Summit County Council July 9th, the general election November 5th. Well, Utah's Governor Spencer Cox will be the Republican candidate for governor after yesterday's primary election. Cox defeated challenger Phil Lyman in the gubernatorial primary. The Associated Press calling the race for Cox with just shy of 60% of the vote, about 170,000 1,000 ballots versus Lyman's 120,000. Cox is seeking a second term as Utah governor, along with Lieutenant Governor Deidre Henderson. He'll go on to face Democrat Brian King in the general election in November. Utahns have not elected a Democratic governor since 1985. The Republican choice for U.S. Senate is John Curtis, who emerged with about 52%, or around 149,000 votes. He's seeking to fill Senator Mitt Romney's seat. Several U.S. House seats were also on the primary ballot. As we mentioned, Blake Moore securing nearly three quarters of the vote there. The race for District 2 was within 4% late Tuesday night, with Celeste Molloy holding a narrow lead. Mike Kennedy won the primary for District 3, representing Park City, Wasatch County, and much of eastern Utah, with about 36% of the vote. And in the state attorney general's race, Derek Brown led the race, and voters picked Tina Cannon for state auditor. Once again, the general election coming up November 5th. Well, cities competing to host the Sundance Film Festival submitted proposals to organizers last week. KPCW's Christine Weller reports some cities are promising millions in financial incentives.
The Sundance Film Festival announced in April it was looking for a new host location for 2027 and beyond. Cities nationwide answered a call for proposals deadline last week, detailing their plans for hosting the event. Utah, the festival's home for 40 years, submitted a bid alongside a couple of cities that announced hefty financial incentives. The Colorado Economic Development Commission approved a one-time $1.5 million incentive as part of Boulder's proposal, and Atlanta and its partners have pledged a $2 million donation if it is chosen. Two other Georgia cities, Savannah and Athens, also submitted proposals. Santa Fe, New Mexico, Buffalo, New York, Minneapolis, and Chicago are also rumored to be in the running. Other cities were rejected. While San Francisco and Traverse City, Michigan announced they were interested in hosting, Sundance did not invite either city to submit a bid. Sundance is expected to choose the festival location for 2027 and beyond by the end of this year or early 2025. Park City will host the 2025 and 2026 Sundance Film Festivals. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
And Park City leaders cut the ribbon on the largest infrastructure project in city history on Monday. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has more on that.
About 200 Parkites got a first look inside the new Three Kings Water Treatment Plant at an open house with the mayor and city council members Monday afternoon. Some 10 years in the making, the plant can churn out over 7 million gallons of water per day. According to Park City Public Utilities Director Clint McAfee, that's an amount that serves around 90% of peak day demand in the summertime. The project, which cost over $100 million, replaces the Spiro water treatment plant. Park City also has a water treatment facility in Quinns Junction. Three Kings treats water from the Judge Tunnel above Main Street, along with the Spiro Tunnel off Three Kings Drive. The plant also receives and distributes water from Rockport Reservoir, according to McAfee.
About 50% of Park City's water comes from water draining from historic mining tunnels, abandoned, which contain the very metals and some bonus metals that the miners of the past were seeking for fortune. In 2010, Park City was realizing the impacts of relying on these sources with an alarming urgency. On numerous occasions, water served to our community was turning brown, the drinking water was, and for short times had metal concentrations above drinking water limits.
The Utah Department of Environmental Quality stepped in to work with the city to reach compliance and develop the plan for the Three Kings plant. Kim Shelley, executive director of the state agency, spoke about the partnership at Monday's event.
There were many hours of meetings, hundreds of hours of technical discussions, and discussions where we prioritized the needs of the community and the regulatory needs that the state of Utah has mandated. And really grateful that we were able to work together to develop an agreement that addressed the concerns that were protective of human health and the environment, but also considered the financial impact to the community. This is a precedent-setting agreement that allowed the time to develop a comprehensive plan and achieve regulatory compliance.
Park City resident John Parker, who attended Monday's open house, said he'll leave water quality to the experts.
It took longer than I thought it would.
Yeah.
Spent more than I thought it would. But if it does the job that it's supposed to, I guess it was well worth it. It's really a beautiful facility.
Three Kings began pumping drinking water to Park City homes in May after state regulators signed off on its operating permit. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Again, just an update. We have got a rollover accident between Jeremy and Kimball, which has now backed up traffic over the summit. That's eastbound Interstate 80, and looks like traffic is just gridlocked at this point. And if you do have any updates, you can always text us at 435-655-8255. And I can update that information as we get it. Coming up, two shows by the popular Aiko Band featuring Ben Anderson, along with the news of a renaming of a foundation to support the work of Park City Song Summit. Also co-founded by Ben Anderson, joining me now in studio, I have Ben Anderson, along with the new executive director of the Song Summit Foundation, Meredith Lavick. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie. Thank you so much for having us on today.
Good morning.
Ben, let's just start with you and talk a little bit about the couple of shows, the show schedule of Aiko. Maybe first just give us a little bit of background on the band. You guys have been playing together for like 3 decades.
40 years. 40. This is our 40th anniversary. Aiko is named after the famous old song, Aiko, Aiko. And, you know, if you think about it, Jerry Garcia played with the Grateful Dead for 30 years, and we've been at it for 40. Now, that's because a few of us are in recovery, something that never really took with Jerry, but we're just happy to still be alive and standing. But not only are we going to play July 4th at the Canyons Forum Fest, but we're so happy to play for the first time at the new marquee PC, the former PC Live, on July 6th. So for both shows, we have the great Eric Krasno playing guitar, Anders Osborne playing guitar. We have Jason Hahn from String Cheese Incident playing percussion. Brad Walker and an amazing brass section from New Orleans coming in. Stanton Moore from Galactic. So if you want to come to that July 6th show, ticket information is at themarqueepc.com. And the trio of Will Blades, Stanton Moore, and Eric Krasno will open up for us, which is probably should be the other way around. But Aiko is thrilled to have all these artists coming in from around the country to help join in on the celebration. So please come out and get some good old Grateful Dead.
Okay, the Canyons show, that's free, right?
That's free, and that's on the 4th of July, and that's a fireworks show. So please, that's family-friendly, so come on out for that.
Okay, what time's the show start?
You know, I think there's 3 acts. We're the last act, so I think the shows start around 5, and then there's another one with my friend Dana Williams will be, his band's playing Silver Strike right before us. They play from 6 to 7:30, and then we are from 8 to 10:15, and then boom, here come the fireworks.
Okay, so we're having real fireworks. Fireworks, eh?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, cool. All right. Why don't you give us some updates then for Song Summit? This has got moved forward by about 2 or 3 weeks.
Yes. So August 15, 16, and 17 is Park City Song Summit. And again, we are returning to the Canyons Village. Our opening night, though, will be at the Marquee PC, and that's on Thursday, August 14. And the great Mavis Staples, who's celebrating 85 years this year, she will be playing that night, and as will a local band, Corey Mon. And then closing out the night will be Sima Funk from Havana, Cuba. And if you haven't seen or danced to Sima Funk, come out and see us on that night. And then it's labs and wellness activities on Friday and Saturday. Full lineup of wonderful labs that the Song Summit Foundation supports and helps underwrite. And that's one of the reasons Meredith, of course, has been brought on board as the new executive director of the Song Summit Foundation, the newly renamed Song Summit Foundation. And then at night at the Amphitheater, which, by the way, the hill has been resloped. There's a brand new stage, came over from Europe, just got here. It's got a canopy on it, and it is going to be tremendous. So if your calves hurt a little bit last year at Song Summit, never fear. First of all, it's okay for your calves to get worked out. But yes, that. And then we have, you know, on the first night, it is Anders Osborne and Jackie Green opening for the wonderful sisters Larkin Poe, and then My Morning Jacket. And then the next night, it is Tank and the Bangas straight out of New Orleans, and then Eric Krasno with a host of friends. And then that night, closing out, is Nathaniel Rateliff and the Night Sweats. So ParkCitySongSummit.com for tickets.
Yeah, how are ticket sales looking?
They are better than ever. We have been setting records within, and we're very excited. But of course, we want to sell more tickets and have more of the community come out. That's why we have them priced from everything from $15 up to $650 if you want to go the full 3 days, or $15 if you want to come out and just hear some really great music. So go grab a price point that works for you and come see us August 14, 15, 16 at Park City Song Summit.
Okay, so it sounds like the time change did you well, the date change.
It really did. Yeah. Moving up a little bit more in the summer has served us well so far.
Great, great. Well, let's introduce Meredith. I mean, I've known Meredith for a long time, but you had just been named as the new executive director of the Song Summit Foundation. Maybe just tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and why this change for you.
Sure. So, yeah, so Leslie and I go way back. Started my career at the Sundance Institute and was there as a program director for over 20 years. Left Sundance in 2020 and headed to Telluride for Original Thinkers, where I was the president of Original Thinkers is an ideas festival that was multimedia. And then after a few years back in Park City, and last year went to Song Summit and just was completely captivated. You know, obviously I love festivals coming out of Sundance, but the power of music beyond just enjoyment, the power of music to heal, to provide wellness, to provide that transformation was really apparent that through the labs and all the discussions, they had this incredible discussion with Daryl, what's his last name?
Yeah, DMC McDaniels
DMC.
And Chuck that's D. right, Meredith. Oh, yeah,
Chuck
D.
With East High School students, which, you know, really reminded me of the work I had done at Sundance with Sundance Ignite, which was nurturing and creating programs for filmmakers 18 to 25. And I thought, wow, this is so cool. This is something I could get behind. And then this position opened up, and I applied, and I thought, this is a really great way to continue my work using the arts for empowerment, for wellness, self-expression. So I'm excited. I think, you know, it's mission-based work, which I always seem to be attracted to, and yeah.
So it was the More Than Music Foundation, an established nonprofit, but you decided to go to just make it simple, Song Summit Foundation. I mean, can you talk a little bit about that, why that changed, Ben?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One is, No, I used to be the president of Mountain Town Music, and my dear friend Brian Richards has been running that for a long time. And, you know, in this world where we try to decrease everything to its first initials, right, and it's MTM, well, we found that we were MTM, and then Mountain Town Music versus More Than Music, they've been around a lot longer than our foundation, and he's a dear friend. And so I said, you know what, why don't we do something that's not confusing in this world of a lot of 501c3s in this town. Like, the last thing we want to do is have there be any confusion over name recognition. But also, I think that, you know, because the mission alignment is so tight between what the wonderful educational works and outreach works that the foundation intends to do, because the mission is so aligned, it's like, why not be the Song Summit Foundation, very much like New Orleans Jazz Fest or Preservation Hall, or there's a Telluride Blues and Brews. A lot of them are for-profit, but then they have a non-for-profit side that's out there doing good that continues their mission. So it just seemed to make sense, and then the foundation board considered that, and that's what they decided to do, and I wouldn't say I'm not happy with it. I'm very happy with it. I think it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, so what is the organization's mission, Song Summit Foundation?
So at Song Summit Foundation, we're the charitable arm of Park City Song Summit, and our mission is to support using the power of wellness, using the power of music, that transformational power to do wellness and healing in mental health, trauma, substance abuse, inclusivity, promote social equity using music and creating programs. And not only that, but we support programs that are working in these spheres.
One of the great things the foundation helps to do initially and just annually is to bring in and underwrite the labs that we're doing, because they touch on all these points Meredith just mentioned, and then they underwrite the wellness activities. So they also work with other nonprofits for things like opioid counteraction and wellness at the event, in the form of safe spaces and clean rooms for the artists, as well as green rooms, but also yoga and meditation. They are the component, they are the underwriter of those facets Hearts of Song Summit. And, you know, as we're doing this fundraiser that's coming up that I know we'll talk about, you know, the foundation is really trying to raise funds to be able to grow these educational opportunities, to be able to reach into the underserved communities and to use maybe their aspirations in the music industry, but also be able to get to them early or to have mentorships that could work with them. So there's a lot of great ideas coming out of the foundation. But of course, you know, it's a newer 501c3.
And yeah. All right. Well, and nothing like just throwing you into a fundraiser. No. But you've got something planned.
2 weeks behind.
You've got something planned for next Tuesday. Tell us about this. Healing Harmonies.
Yeah. Yes, we have a really exciting event. It's going to be special. It's called Healing Harmonies, Songwriting with Soldiers. And that's a nonprofit, Songwriting with Soldiers, out of Nashville. And they work with veterans and military, active military, to help them understand, make sense of their experience, get through their trauma by using, creating songs, music. And it's really powerful. And we have, I'm going to throw this to Ben to talk about because he knows these guys so well, but we have Jay Clemente, Danny Murek, and Aaron Enderlin, who are coming.
Yeah.
And they're going to do a lab with Ben, which is a discussion about the work they're doing. And then they're going to perform. So, Ben, take it away.
Yeah, some of the most, thanks, Meredith, some of the most amazing healing that goes on is with music. And so it naturally makes sense for combat veterans and, you know, veterans who are trying to have re-entry into society. It's very tough because they've been isolated. They need to rebuild trust. And what better way they found than with songwriting circles so that they can tell their stories and release some of that pain and be able to connect with themselves and other combat veterans in songwriting circles and to work with mentors, you know, pretty heady songwriters that have a lot of number one hits like Danny Myrick, that can work with them to help them write their songs, to get this pain, to get these emotions out in the form of song. And the healing that's taking place around the country with these veteran songwriting circles is amazing. And so that's at the National Ability Center on July 2nd. And for ticket information, you can go to our website, parkcitysongsummit.com, and then you go over to the Foundation tab and just go right there and buy tickets. We would really love for the community to come out and support the foundation and to support the good work that's going on in our veteran community through the power of song.
Okay, tickets $100 per person, but you're offering a half price for folks, veterans and active military?
Actually, we're just hosting all veterans and military.
Oh, nice.
I think initially we thought half price, but now we've decided, you know, it's really important. And first responders. So if you're a first responder, active military or a veteran, you're our guest that night. Your plus ones can come too. Please join us. This is, it's going to be a really powerful event. And you know, I think it's a great example of how the foundation supports the work of Park City Song Summit. We'll be doing all the, you know, we'll be doing year-round events like this. And then at the actual Song Summit in August, you know, come see us at the Village, because that's where we'll be with all our wellness activities.
Okay. So again, this is again happening Tuesday the 2nd from 6 to, doors open at 6, 6:30 to 9, food and beverage for purchase, and then again, the
Yeah, then I'll do a panel. I'll interview these folks, and then they will play some great music. So next week's a big week. You got, yeah, at the NAC on July 2nd, the Song Summit Foundation with Songwriting with Soldiers. July 4th, come see Ico's 40th up on the mountain. And then July 6th on Main Street. What better way? One more Saturday night. Come out and enjoy the music from a lot of musicians around the country. Music is healing. Music is love.
Okay. Ben, Meredith, thanks so much.
Thanks, Leslie.
Thank you, Leslie.
You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. The Park City Council has two council meetings this week, meeting on both Thursday and Friday. In the studio with a preview, I have City Manager Matt Dias and Trails and Open Space Manager Heinrich Dieters. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for having us.
Let's see. Thursday's meeting, Matt, a one-item work session starting at 3 o'clock and then discussion at the regular meeting at 6, specifically and only about the Bonanza Park small area plan. This is the area, of course, and we're talking about from Park Avenue and Kearns east to Bonanza Drive, everything but the 5 acres that is being planned separately with the Kimball Arts Center and a dense mixed-use community plan there. But even without this Bonanza Park small area plan being approved, we've got already the Engine House affordable housing project going. going on. We've got plans in for the redo of the Doubletree Yarrow parcel. The Windsors, who own a lot of property along Iron Horse Drive, have also expressed some interest in what they can do to redevelop their property. So it sounds like this area has really kind of planned itself without having to go through all of this, except for, what, the Snow Creek area?
Well, you know, I guess as a counter to that, that's actually a pretty common phenomenon, that property owners will sort of vest their rights under the existing code. We see that frequently throughout the town when we are contemplating area plans, land management changes, and otherwise. So not surprised at all that we have a bunch of property owners considering redevelopment and either in the process or have some vested rights under the existing code. Our thought, though, is through this comprehensive planning process, several of these entities are actually holding out. They're seeing what the community values are in this area that may or may not be expressed through the planning process. Our hope is that the code amendments and the plan and otherwise are progressive enough that the property owners are going to want to get involved in it and may take advantage of any new planning exercises or new amendments to the code. And so, very common phenomenon, a property owner will vest their rights, take advantage of the existing code, ensure that they're satisfied, but they're forward-looking. In a redevelopment area that's going to take place over 10 or 15 years, that gives property owners, public and private, the opportunity to take advantage of this new planning process and the outputs from it. What's interesting is that these are coming back together. If you'll recall, about a year, year and a half ago, we started these together. And at the time, we also had several applications that were either pending or pre-application where people were vesting their rights. And it's interesting because we started the small area plan, which is the overall area, as well as the five-acre feasibility. We started those together. We realized it was a little sticky. It may be confusing for people, but we really thought we had to begin them concurrently. So it's really neat that we're back here a little over a year later where we have some really big decisions to make, I'd say, in the next quarter where these come back together.
So what residents may want to know, I guess, is that the frontage protection zone, I mean, and protection, I think, is the key word there, will be up to Planning Commission discretion. So what used to be hard and fast setbacks now sounds like it's up for negotiation. How does this benefit residents? It seems like the only benefits by allowing more density is to the developer. And as I note, the staff report says, pending the adoption of the small area plan by the City Council, the Planning Commission wants a joint work session with the council to discuss community benefits and the thresholds to obtain density bonuses early in the code amendment process.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I think that's a really important element of the potential changes under consideration here. It is very common under a progressive land management code or a performance-based code where when the community gets a greater return on the private sector's development, it may be able to offer something in exchange. And so the Planning Commission and the Council have an opportunity to consider elevated level of transit services, elevated level of walkability or pedestrian amenities, elevated levels of affordable housing and otherwise. And there may be an exchange that's codified in the code that allows for this exchange to happen transparently and in the public in the open, where the private developer can offer something in exchange for some gives or some gets with the public sector where we get these community benefits. Now, to be careful, the Planning Commission and our staff believes that we need to have a joint meeting with the City Council and the Planning Commission to consider sort of this level of prioritization. What type of elements and how much would warrant these types of transactions within the code, in a public meeting, after public hearings? But this is, again, it's a pretty common phenomenon happening in cities and towns across North America, to say, where we would identify our wants and needs that exceed the requirements of the private sector.
This is one of the most congested intersections in town. I'm talking about Kearns Boulevard and Bonanza Drive. And sure, this planning promises pedestrian and bicycle links through the area. That basically goes away during the winter and everybody gets into a car. So with that much more density, what are the traffic engineers saying needs to be done to deal with what is already without this additional density, gridlock at times?
Well, I think the gridlock is a considerable issue that we're going to need to deal with, but that's a community-wide issue that we're working with the county, we're working with the state in a variety of areas. And I think when we're contemplating development in some of the most congested areas of town, we obviously need to be sensitive to those impacts. And I think the draft plan, and that, and I believe that's why it centers on additional amenities for pedestrians and bike and walkability and connectivity year-round. And I think it's even written in the report. This isn't just a seasonal aspect. So if you come to Main Street in the winter, you see tens of thousands of people here for events, for music festivals, to see concerts, visit our restaurants, and otherwise. And I would argue we need to deploy the same level of pedestrian experience, bike experience, throughout a year-round to try to reduce our impacts. However, development brings impacts. I'm not going to overlook that. I don't want to pretend like there can't be any impacts here. You and I have traveled around the world, around the country. Yeah, this is a relatively urban area at the bottom of a box canyon that has traffic and congestion, but it can also be incredibly vibrant. It can be a locals area. It can be connected in a way that it isn't today. You know, yesterday I was just at a meeting. I was talking to an older woman in our community that's been here, and she said, "Matt, this is crazy. I can't ride my bike through this area. I can't walk through this area. It's incredibly important the decisions that we make here provide better level of safety and connectivity. I believe through the built environment, there's some incredible choices that we can make that can accelerate those, but I can't negate the fact that there will be traffic and congestion impacts."
All right, so there's no decision set for Thursday. The council will discuss it. Does that happen at Friday's meeting? I didn't see it on the agenda.
So I think it's intentionally taking sort of a pause, allowing the council to consider the feedback from the Planning Commission and not scheduling it for an up or down vote. So it's continued to a date certain. It also contemplates a joint meeting. Again, we have two things that are sort of happening in the ether here. We have the 5-acre feasibility, and we have the small area plan, which is the overarching strategic plan for the area. These two are converging after about a year of public input and public engagement. So we're really happy to be at this point, but we're also not going to be making a foolish decision to just move too fast. I think we still want to be methodical and be respectful of the process.
All right, so on Friday, we have an agenda that looks much more like a regular Thursday agenda, but it starts at 10 a.m., so why the change up?
Well, I just think, to be fair, two things were happening. We needed a lot of time to consider the small area plan, and we wanted to bring back our consultants after about 3.5 weeks on the 5-acre feasibility. And we really just needed a working meeting where we could wipe the table clean, go to the back of the room, and not be confined by approving contracts and amendments to code and otherwise. So we bifurcated these intentionally. We have this long-term strategic planning meeting on Thursday occurring. And then on Friday morning, we'll be in for doing regular business, sort of the day-to-day operational needs of the municipality.
Okay, so on Friday, no work session, but council will be considering an ordinance for e-bike use in Clark Ranch. E-bikes are already allowed there, Heinrich, so what's the change?
Well, for the listeners, this will be the third meeting that the council discusses this year, and we even had one last fall associated, and sort of the culmination of, on May 2nd, we came back to the council and we did another community survey where we asked residents, as well as in an online survey, you know, what their sentiments were towards the regulations and resources associated. We came back again on May 23rd and we had a more directed discussion associated with projects. And so that was the meeting where council gave the direction of posting 15-mile-an-hour speed limit on the pathways. Another component of that was a pilot project over in the Deer Valley area. So this is the third one, and basically what we're asking council this evening is to amend the ordinance to allow the designation of e-bike trails. Now, specifically to your question, Clark Ranch trails were trails that were built before that was in city limits. I think you probably recall. It's a very popular area. We see a lot of people out there. It's been a huge success. We're adopting those amendments to codify sort of that existing condition out there, as well as implement the pilot program that the council directed on the 23rd.
Okay, and so that pilot program is for e-bike use in Deer Valley, for lower Deer Valley, for everybody?
Yeah, so we're working with our partners, Deer Valley, on that, and we're identifying a system actively right now, identifying a system that really works for e-bike users over there. So the direction from council is to connect towards the Deer Valley East area, and so that's what we're working on, and we're hoping to provide all that information on Friday.
Okay. Council will also be considering the approval of a State Route 248 transit study and pre-NEPA. This is like the environmental work. This is going to entail a $1 million plus contract, Matt, to do exactly what? I mean, are we talking about widening the road again?
Well, I like to believe that won't be the case, because I believe the community input we've heard doesn't support that. However, I don't want to get ahead of the community. We will, of course, collect a lot of feedback and community engagement. Those types of decisions can be made through this process. To take a step back, this is the sort of sister process to what the county undertook for SR 248 to bring on the bus rapid transit system. It is required as a component to obtain federal funding. And there's an alternatives analysis, an environmental analysis. A preferred alternative will be the result of this, which means it'll consider modes and other types of things for the SR 248 corridor. Our hope, stepping back, is that we have an integrated and comprehensive system at some point where the buses and the signals and the roads and the equipment are all integrated. And so this is the kind of sister component to what's occurring on SR 248. In other jurisdictions, this has taken years to accomplish. I think the EIS and the Cottonwood Canyons is on year 5 or year 6 or year 7. We're trying to get this done in about a year and a half because we're relying on the previous analysis that we did up in 2019. But a big project on one of our two arterials in town will cost tens of millions of dollars, and there's an opportunity here to have the federal fund or funding process potentially fund up 60, almost 70% of that. And so we'd be crazy not to take advantage of the federal funding. But for that, we would have to do this entirely on the back of Park City Municipal. Fortunately, though, this study is funded in partnership with Summit County using the Summit County third quarter sales tax, which we enacted together about 5 or 6 years ago. And so it's a grant funded through Summit County, and it's a return on the tourism economy. The tourism economy largely pays the sales tax in our community. We're redeploying that into this investment so we can obtain federal funding.
A year and a half to do this study, and the report says that this is an aggressive time frame. And I guess it's just baffling to me to find out that we don't have the information that we need to based on the number of studies. You know, I mean, the report shows one done in 09, a UDOT report in 2015 and 2015, an environmental assessment done over 3 years, 2017 to 2020, a short range transit plan in 2023. It's just hard to believe that we need one more.
I don't disagree. I guess I could say the same thing, you know, 5 years ago when Summit County began this process. It's like we've looked at 224 for years and years and years, but it's a necessity. It's required for us to obtain federal funding. Every other city and town goes through this. When Provo did their light rail BRT in downtown, they had to go through this process too. Whatever investments we make in this corridor, they are more or less permanent investments. They'll be there for the next 50 to 70 years. We don't want to get it wrong. You know, often when I'm in this chair, we will receive criticism for, you know, sort of, what can you do for me tomorrow? Why haven't you done it already? And I think when we get into that mode, you know, the next criticism I get is, why aren't we being more strategic and doing more long-term planning? And so it's sort of like it's a balancing act where you have to be doing both concurrently. And depending on who you're talking with, there's sort of never enough of one or there's too much of another. This is a requirement for us to get federal funding, and we're very grateful that Summit County is our partner in it. Again, taking that step back, our hope is to have an integrated system where we can get some people out of their cars outside town, bump them into a transit system that's integrated with High Valley Transit, provide a different level of experience in this community for the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years.
All right. Also, towards the end of the agenda, an update, I guess, on the Rocky Mountain Power Transmission Line Underground Project. There was no staff report with that. Can you give us the latest? What's happening?
I mean, I'm a little bit in the dark myself, so I apologize. What we've been doing here is really pushing Rocky Mountain Power with our effort to underground the transmission lines coming out of the substation in the Bonanza area, going all the way across the cemetery and then through the back of Boot Hill, kind of back behind the snow, not snow country, help me with the shopping center back there. I'm forgetting the name. Drawing a blank.
Well, where the old Adolphs was, where
yeah, that the, sort of that entire area, yeah, cutting across that hillside. And so, you know, normally we would have a comprehensive staff report. I would know the presentation, but we've been really pushing Rocky Mountain Power that this is an incredibly important infrastructure project. It's important to the 5-acre site. It's important to the small area plan. And so I actually don't have the information ahead of time. We've been setting a hard date with our partner. And unfortunately, like some other things, we haven't been able to get those materials ahead of time. But the gist of it is trying to partner with Rocky Mountain Power to underground the transmission lines, open up that area for the redevelopment, and also reduce some of the visual impacts of the power lines and the bigger poles, in addition to wildfire hardening and reducing some of our vulnerability moving forward.
Yeah, so the substation stays where it is?
For the time being, we also have direction from the mayor and council to reconsider the location of the substation, but we're taking, and if you're going to eat an elephant, you have to eat it in bites, and we're taking this in phases. The first phase is, let's work on undergrounding the transmission lines, irrespective of where that substation is. That district will need a power source, and it will need transmission and distribution lines. And so that won't be a wasted investment. The first phase is underground the transmission lines. Second phase is, can we contemplate working with Rocky Mountain Power an opportunity to relocate that substation and pull it out of the redevelopment zone? I'm getting way ahead of myself. You're probably like, hey, Matt, we've lived through that three or four times already. That may be the case. I'm reminded that life is about timing, and sometimes you need sort of the critical mass, and you need things to happen and line up in the right way. But I believe in a phased approach, this transmission line first sort of phrase is really exciting, and we have a lot of potential here. We're going to have to negotiate hard with Rocky Mountain Power, but they are a partner.
Right. All right. And then it's that time to renew the DABS, that's the Utah Department of Alcoholic Beverage Services lease for the liquor store here under KPCW. They get a terrific deal. How come?
Well, I was here in 2001 during the Olympics, and if most folks will recall, there was a liquor store on Main Street, and I believe it was below the museum downstairs. And it was hard to find and wasn't easily accessible, but it was really important to Old Town residents and Old Town business owners and small business owners to have this facility in town. It also stops a lot of people from taking trips, you know, to other areas in town to go to the liquor store. And so at that time, it was sort of curated as a quality of life amenity, as a livability amenity to both the business district and the residents in Old Town. And we have an existing letter of support from the Historic Park City Alliance that it remains a priority for this area, and we still think it's an important livability component for those that live here. They can take the stairs down, they can take our pathways, the visitors and tourists can pick up something on their way to dinner. And so if we continue to hear from our community that this is a priority, there'll be a public hearing. I think this is a worthy investment, but we get to reconsider this every couple of years and things can change. So at current, we're reconsidering this once again and making a determination if this continues to be a priority for the livability of the business district and Old Town.
All right. Well, Main Street merchants may want to cover their ears just when they hear this price. I mean, it's like they're right now, their liquor store is paying $7.06 a square foot. We're talking about raising that to $7.41 a square foot, and then eventually up to about $7.78 a square foot.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. So, you know, but for this subsidized lease, the liquor store would be gone. There's no way the Utah Department of Alcoholic Beverages would have a site here. They would likely move all of their resources over to the other shopping center or even further outside of town. They're on the record as saying that this is a partnership sort of between a community and the state, but for that, the liquor store wouldn't be there. The volume isn't enough. They have trouble staffing it. There's a myriad of reasons that it's not a preferable location. There's not a return on investment. But fortunately, we have a very strong relationship, and it's important to the business district. And so the state is accommodating.
Okay. Real quick, any updates on fireworks? As you know, it's been a dry, hot summer so far. We're going to do a drone show, I know, here in Park City, but what about for the rest of us who do like fireworks?
I believe that's coming in a couple weeks. You and I have lived through a lot of these. We're typically sometime in July. The chief building official and fire marshal for the municipality will get together with the Park City Fire District and make a determination. So forthcoming, and thank you for mentioning the drone show. You know, that's part of the municipality's effort to reduce our impact and not have some type of an accident and be responsible for it.
And all the dogs love you for it.
One more, if I could. I know Heinrich was here. He's already left. I just want to thank him for his service. As some folks know, he is leaving the municipality in the next couple weeks. Heinrich and his family have decided to take sort of a sabbatical and a sojourn overseas. And so 17 years with the municipality, started as an intern, worked his way all the way up to a department head, and has done an incredible amount of work in our backcountry and wildfire management, trails, open space acquisition, conservation easements. He's been an incredible ambassador for the organization and for their community. I'm not saying he's gone forever, but they are taking off, and we wish him well, and it's a wonderful opportunity for Heinrich and his family.
Okay, well, I wish you would have stayed around. Thank you.
Thanks, Leslie. I appreciate it.
It's Park City Manager Matt Dias. In the studio now with a look ahead at some upcoming events in Park City. I've got Special Events Manager Jenny Jerson along with Special Events Coordinator Heather Weinstock. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Let's start with Park City's Sunday Market. I know we're trying to preserve Jenny's voice here, so I don't know if you want to take it or Heather, but we're cutting it down to just two markets in July and then none for August.
That's right. So the event is held on Lower Main from 10 to 5. This is the last Sunday, and then there will be no Silly Market held on July 7th, July 28th, or all of August. So there's a couple of July dates where the event will be held, but then there is a little bit of break, and then the event will return in September. I did quickly want to mention that we have increased transit from Richardson Flat for the event this year. We've seen about a 66% increase in ridership with the increased frequency on Sundays. That is kind of system-wide, but we're seeing somewhere between 300 and 400 people parking out there on Sundays, and we just appreciate that so much, and we love seeing that success and appreciate our transit team for increasing that transit.
Okay, people can ride their bikes and they can park for free at the bike valet, and we kind of bumped up paid parking to discourage people from coming in town.
Yeah, so those decisions, the paid parking and the transit were made together. That's part of our transportation demand management strategy. So again, with that increased transit, increasing that paid parking, we are still seeing paid parking in Old Town on Sundays is maxing out at around 11:30 in the morning, and we see that trend happen until about 4:30 or 5 until the event is over. So again, just really encouraging people when they're coming up here on Sundays to consider alternate modes of transportation. And you know, the event is super fun, lots of locals attending the event and also lots of local vendors, so just encouraging people to get out there and support the event and our Main Street merchants if you haven't gotten out there yet this summer.
Okay, are you seeing an improvement in folks kind of cutting through the residential streets?
You know, we've been working on that for years now. I think it's been 5 or more years. We've really put a lot of effort in it, both in the city and with our event applicants in the community. And the answer is yes. I think there has been significant improvement with the amount of mitigation that we've put out there. And again, just appreciate everybody for, you know, it's to go along with the Chamber's sustainable tourism thing, it's just a nice thing to do. If you go to any other community, you wouldn't want people cutting through neighborhoods, et cetera. So just when you're getting around, whether it's during Silly Market or this coming weekend for 4th of July, just consider some of those things and kind of take a step back and realize what you'd want in your own backyard.
Okay, well, let's shift gears to the 4th of July. That's happening a week from tomorrow, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. And so who wants to give us details about the parade and all of the other activities, Heather?
Yeah, I can give some details. So next Thursday, 4th of July, we have a lot of fun activities going on, things that everybody will recognize. Of course, we have the parade that begins at 11 a.m. This year, we have 74 floats, all local businesses, organizations, and residents. Based on that number, we anticipate that the parade will last about an hour and a half. We do have our Grand Marshal confirmed. That's Miles Radiman. He, you know, has done so much for this community, believes in loving where you live and digging in to make it even better. Over the past 35 years, he's done exactly that. He's worked on preserving history, saving open space, promoting trails, championing the Winter Olympics in 2002, served on so many nonprofit boards, and of course, for the last 30 years, he's directed Park City's award-winning community leadership program. And so if you want the full schedule of events, including starting from this Sunday to next Saturday, it's just a busy time in the community, you can find that on Park City's website. And then for Park City itself celebrations, starting at 8 a.m., we have the 5K put on by Cole Sports that will be in the Park City Mountain area in support of Park City Ski and Snowboard. You do have to register in advance. We have the link on our website as well. We have our annual police memorial on Main Street at 9 a.m. Book sale at the library at 10 a.m. We will have a flyover from Hill Air Force Base at 10:45, parade at 11 a.m., and then, as always, fun games and food at City Park all day, 12:30 to about 4, and then drone show at Park City Mountain at 10 p.m. Tune into KPCW. They will be playing some fun patriotic music that you can listen to as the drone show is going on. We have volleyball tournament as well and rugby.
Okay. So what does this mean for road closures? Because we've got to shut down Main Street for the parade.
So starting at 6 a.m., we will not have any parking on Main Street and Speed Alley and Park Avenue and City Park. That'll go until about 2 p.m. It'll actually be closed all of City Park area all day just due to all of the different activities going on. It'll be a hard road closure along that parade route. So starting on Speed Alley where we have all of the floats lining up, going down Main Street, down to Park Avenue. That'll be around 8 a.m. to about 1 p.m. or when the street is clear. We will have parking. It'll be a $30 flat rate per car in China Bridge until 1 p.m. And then new this year is parking will be free after 1 p.m. in China Bridge to invite people back to Main Street to support local businesses.
Okay. And you do have an agreement with Park City Mountain then for people to park there?
Correct. Yep. There, Deer Valley Resort, Park City High School, and then Richardson Flat. Just like a lot of our other big events, we are going to be increasing transit. So there will be increased service from Richardson Flat every 10 minutes.
Okay, and with the bus lane on Deer Valley Drive, it is just faster to
correct.
Get on the bus.
Yeah, we highly encourage everybody to take public transit.
Okay, let's see. No fireworks, but we do have the drone show.
Correct, yep.
All right, and in terms of people accessing their homes in Old Town, what do they need to do?
Yep, so we have passed out resident access passes. We went door to door a while ago. Anybody from 15th Street to Chambers need those resident access passes. If you lost yours or need another one, please reach out to our department and we can get those to you.
Okay, people should sign up for text alerts, 888-777. Just set PC events to that number. And Deer Valley Music Festival starting up this week, so again, we've got a specialized traffic route for that. Jenny?
Yes, for concerts over 3,000 people, we'll have that special traffic routing up there to help reduce traffic up in that area. And, you know, we just really hope everybody has a safe and fun holiday.
Okay. All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW Park City.